Now, for our text this morning, we'll be focusing on Matthew 7, verse 12, golden rule. But in connection with that, we'll read the context of chapter 7, verses 1 through 12. We are kind of getting to the end of the Sermon on the Mount here, especially after this, verses 13 and onward of chapter 7, focus more as warnings with regards to what if happens if you do not follow God's or the teaching of Jesus Christ and his law and work and believe in him, being more so the conclusion of his sermon. So Matthew 7, verses 1 through 12. Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye, and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite! First, take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet, and then turn and tear you to pieces. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks the door will be opened. Which of you, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. And that is the word of our Lord Jesus Christ for this morning. Beloved congregation of our Lord Jesus Christ, that last verse that we just read, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. Well, we generally know that most likely as the golden rule. According to some, the story behind that title or that name for it is that there was a Roman emperor, Alexander Severus. He wasn't a Christian himself. Apparently, he was very friendly to Christians and Jews. But he learned about this rule, probably from some Christian, and loved it. He appreciated it so much that he made it kind of his own motto. He put it on public buildings. He put it somewhere in a wall in his palace. And one of them, probably the palace wall, he did that in golden letters, making it the golden rule. I'm not sure how much of that is true or when that actually started to begin called or was starting to begin to be called the golden rule. It's even maybe hard to know exactly which version of the rule he wrote down. There's here where Jesus is positive and says, do to others what you would have them do to you. Others might think of the negative version of that. Don't do to others what you would have them do, what you don't want done to you. But either way, it's not too surprising that even a pagan emperor would appreciate the words of Jesus Christ. In many different cultures, many different philosophies, you'll find something like it. Though generally, mostly, the negative form, don't do to others what you would not want them to do to you. It's as if there is a general agreement almost that this is wisdom. This is a great rule, something that, yeah, you should put on your wall in golden letters. But putting this rule on your wall in golden letters is maybe also typical of the way we kind of treat this. These words of Jesus, they are beautiful, wonderful words. Hardly anyone is going to disagree. We applaud the wisdom that's exhibited. We comment on how profound it actually is and how applicable it is for really every problem and every situation in life. We teach it to kids, reminding them that they should be nice to their siblings or something like that. But we probably also all realize that it's the follow-through for each one of us that is really difficult. As one preacher said and reminds us, the law wasn't meant to be praised, but to be practiced. Our Lord did not preach the Sermon on the Mount in order that you and I might comment on it, but in order that we may carry it out. And that's the harder part when we read such wonderful, profound, beautiful words of our Lord Jesus Christ. The words aren't just for our walls. They're for our hearts. And let's look at that then this morning. The teachings of Jesus Christ, the golden rule. We'll look at 2 points again. The rule to sum up all rules, and then its golden character. Now, verse 12 begins with that little word, so. So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. Telling us that in some ways, this isn't just a standalone verse. There are some translations who kind of put it separate, and there might be good reasons for that, but you cannot just read it on its own. So, Jesus says, it's summing up or connecting with something that's above. Most likely connects right away to those verses that we just read. Chapter 7, it fits there very well. However, if we read that whole verse, as I just did, you also note that at the end he says, for this sums up the law and the prophets. And that reminds us of something else that Jesus says right at the has said right at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, where he talks about the law and the prophets and how he came to fulfill it. That's why we started reading from chapter 5 at the beginning. Jesus begins his Sermon on the Mount with quite an extensive teaching on the law of God. And he uses that refrain, as I pointed out, you've heard that it was said, or something like it, but I tell you. And then Jesus discusses these many different laws, clarifying what they are, clarifying how broad they apply, and what is actually meant and required in these laws. And now, near the end of his Sermon on the Mount, just kind of before the conclusion or the epilogue and its warnings, he refers back to the law and the prophets just one more time. One more time to make sure we actually get it. So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. Actually, you could even translate it even stronger, saying something like, for in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this is the law and the prophets. This is the law and the prophets. Consider that for a second. Jesus is addressing his disciples. Remember that from last week? That's how the Sermon on the Mount begins. He sees the crowds coming towards him, and then he leads his disciples into the hill country, into a mountain, and he starts talking, speaking to his disciples. Surely others would have heard him, but it's for his disciples particularly. I mean, these disciples are fishermen, but they are Jewish. They would have been instructed in everything that came with their religion and what God had done in the Old Testament. They would have had been instructed in the law as any Jewish person would have. They probably knew much of it by heart. They would have known the Ten Commandments. They would have known much of the ceremonial law and the sacrifices and all that had to go with that. Jesus isn't talking to Gentiles or to recent converts who need a primer on the law. He's talking to his disciples and probably the Jewish people who also had all gathered from all over Israel to listen to him. And yet he takes the time to go through so many of these different laws to explain them and their true significance. And again, he wraps it up with this statement, trying to include all of it, trying to boil it all down, saying, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this is the law and the prophets. Why does Jesus have to do that? Why does he have to do that at the beginning? Why does he have to do that at the end again? Don't the disciples know the law and the prophets? Couldn't they turn to their Hebrew Bible and say, this is the law and the prophets, this is basically all the books of the Bible? written the law, 5 books of Moses, all that was written by the prophets. This is it. We know it. Don't we know it? Don't we know our Old Testament? Don't we hear at least every Sunday the Ten Commandments? That we would say, yeah, I know God's law and what he requires of us. Why end on this note? What is Jesus getting at here? Well, throughout his sermon, and especially now again at the end, Jesus is uncovering or showing the spiritual character of the law. He is teaching us that there is more to the law than just the bare words. The bare words of the commands. Because apparently, we don't usually get this or understand it. That isn't really that surprising, is it? As much as we may know the law, we don't always understand or respect its true character. Might say that we have a mechanical view, often have a mechanical view of the law. Meaning something like we see the law as, and God's commandments as something on their own. They're just like a standalone thing. A hurdle, a burden, an inconvenience to try and get around. That the law is our to-do list, like as if a machine could just randomly punch out a bunch of different things that you had to do, you could check them off, and then finally you'd be done, and you had time for yourself then. And like a machine, you can't, there isn't anything, there's no reason behind it, you can't talk with it, you can't ask it questions, it would never have a deeper meaning, like a machine wouldn't have any kind of deeper meaning to it. That's kind of maybe how we treat the law. The law is impersonal, it's detached, it's an end in itself, and it serves no higher or greater goal or purpose. I don't think that's just God's law that where we have that kind of a response. I think that's what happens with most laws. It's kind of our default position when we're told to do something. For example, kids. Consider this. What if your mom told you something, you wanted to go play outside, and she told you, yes, you can, but you shouldn't go stomp around, play around in the puddles in front of the house. Maybe it's even like in the last couple days, probably some puddles around your house as things were melting, and you wanted to go outside, and yep, puddles are really tempting to go play in. So you go outside. You don't go in front of the house, you go behind the house. And there's a puddle there too. What do you think? Would it cross your mind thinking like, okay, so mom actually said, don't play or stomp around in the puddles in front of the house, but that probably means that the puddles in the back of the house, behind the house, are free game, right? Like they're good to go. Would something like that cross your mind? Would that be the defense you would go with once you came into the house all wet and muddy and saying, but you didn't say anything about those puddles behind the house? I wouldn't be surprised if you were saying like, yeah, that probably would cross my mind. I might not do it, or maybe I would, but it definitely crossed my mind because we've all done it and we've all thought those kind of thoughts. One part of our brain gives us the rationale that, yes, we have a good reason to do our own thing because guess what? The law didn't talk about this. Mom didn't mention this. And yet also at the same time, when once we're called out, we know better. We know actually what the law was about. And yet we technically didn't break the law. Technically, we didn't play in the puddles in front of the house. But isn't that example also very interesting? At the same time, we become the biggest legalists, the best lawyers, because we know the law exactly and what it says. And at the same time, we do that so that we may be the biggest law breakers and find a way to get around them. The biggest legalists in following the letter of the law, and yet the biggest lawbreakers because we know that we're breaking the spirit of the law and the purpose of the law, and yet we'll have even our defense ready. That is the kind of mechanical view of the law, right? You just consider the words of the law. You don't consider what your mom may be thinking or how she told you not to get dirty because here you have to leave in 30 minutes. That wasn't important to you. You just cared about her words, the law, and the way to get around it so that you could do what you wanted. And we all do that. The more we consider the law to be impersonal, to just some words to abide by and possibly get around, the more we'll be tempted to be the greatest legalists and also lawbreakers. I'm sure you can think, every one of us can think of their own examples when it comes to growing up or when it comes to even the health regulations we've been dealing with in the last couple of months. And most importantly, when it comes to God's law. We excuse ourselves. We have our defense ready. We're saying, technically, the law says. Technically, that's not gossip. Technically, that's not sex. The Bible doesn't explicitly say something about cyberbullying. And we find a way to be both righteous in our own eyes and yet do our own thing at the same time. This is why Jesus spends so much time on the law at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, and he brings it home in the end, saying, So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. He smashes our mechanical view of the law with the spirit of the law. And whatever else we do, and all that God's law says about it, consider what you would have other people do to you. The law isn't mechanical. It's not impersonal. It is spiritual and personal. Jesus shows us its spiritual character by saying, this is the law and the prophets. It's not an addition to the law. It's not some deeper, secret, hidden meaning of the law. No, this is its true purpose and true goal. All of it, of God's law. Just as God had told his people in the Old Testament to love your neighbor as yourself. And the law is personal. Jesus starts to give it shape in the person of our neighbor, as we'll see, but it's really going to be about himself. And we'll see that too. Having looked at that, we'll see the ending of why is Jesus saying that. Let's now consider, what is the spiritual nature of the law? What does Jesus say it is? Do to others what you would have them do to you. Consider what this command is actually addressing. I mean, I've already shown and we've already seen how the law can easily be made into something that is mechanical and detached, but at the end of the day, our real problem isn't just our relationship with the law. It's not as if everything's fixed after this sermon because, I explained to you the law, or Jesus explained to us the law, and now we can live our lives and be perfect people. It's not that we don't understand the law or that we don't actually know what is meant. Most of the time we know very well what the law actually intends and what it means and what is required of us. No, the problem is actually our self-centeredness, our sinfulness, that we want to do our own thing, that we decide for ourselves what we want to do, that we put ourselves above the laws, and that the laws get in the way of what we want and what we want to do. And this problem doesn't just change our relationship with some law. Remember, the law is not impersonal. It changes our relationship with God and changes our relationship with our neighbor. Looking at the world around us and looking at our own hearts, we see that how the problem isn't that there aren't enough laws. If so, by now, we should have figured out the exact laws we need. No, the problem is our sinful nature. We're turned inward. We're turned in on ourselves that we are self-centered. But consider then also what Jesus does. He uses our self-centeredness and really flips it. He turns it outward. We generally know what we want and what we want other people to do for us. With us at the center, we generally have a good idea on how we want everyone else around us to behave and treat us. That's that self-centeredness again. But Jesus shakes us really out of that. He asks us to use that same consideration that we always have because of our self-centeredness and say, how about you put someone else at the center? How about you do that, but now you do it for others? Treat them with the love, with the respect, with the kindness and encouragement as you know you would like them to show you. Let's go a bit deeper then. Do you see what that actually is based on? And how Jesus starts even to shake our self-centeredness a little bit more? You see what we get to wrestle with here. Jesus' command is based on the fact that, well, actually, others are just like yourself. Others are just like yourself. That is why the things that you desire, the things that you would appreciate, the things that you would want, are actually also the things that another person would appreciate, want, and love from you. Now think about how that goes against the grain of much of what we experience in life. How often in life don't we get stuck in the thinking of it's us, it's me versus them? Isn't it almost strange how often that actually happens? You could be happily married or not, and you would suddenly find yourself thinking of this way just because you realize that suddenly your spouse and you are on opposite sides when it comes to your interests or your plans or your dreams. Instead of thinking of like where all along you could think like we're a team, and all of a sudden you realize, why am I thinking as her, as him, as an opponent? Happens with siblings. You get along with your siblings all right for most of the day, and suddenly something happens, and all of a sudden you're trying to put them in their place. Try to put them in their place for whatever reason. Possibly, maybe mostly because you think that they're getting something that you deserve, or that they're getting too much attention, or whatever it may be. All along, you can think of them as brothers and sisters, siblings, who are there, your friends, and now all of a sudden you turn on one another. Happens in the church. We get carried away on things that happen, on various issues, and we only see for or against, with ourselves always as the main reference point. And overlooking the fact that we are one church, one body, we're brothers and sisters of Jesus Christ. You don't have to look very far. It happens in the world all the time. Many small or great issues will have at its heart that division, that rivalry, the people who that we just tend, because of our self-centeredness, to make ourselves a reference point and look at the world as for or against. Everyone ends up being measured, in that sense, according to how unlike us they are. And in that sense, then they become rivals, opponents, challenges, threats, and it's near impossible to do good to them as long as we are the reference point. And Jesus shakes us up and says, use the other as your reference point. Put yourself in their shoes. And guess what? You will find out how much alike you actually are when you do to others what you would have them do to you. We can't get to this point, not yet, to really understand and have the full impact of Jesus' words, because we haven't yet even considered the immediate context of our text. Because after all that I've just mentioned, after all that we've just seen, it's not strange that Jesus has a section on not judging one another just before our text. Right? That's where we started in chapter 7. Talks about not judging, you will be, for how you judge, you will be For the way that you judge, you will be judged, you will be measured according to the measure that you use. He goes on, do not give dogs what is sacred, do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample on them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. And in some ways, it would have been fit very well to then right away jump to verse 12, where Jesus just says, after knowing this about judging, about knowing this about the law, so in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. But no, Jesus doesn't do that. He doesn't end right there. He puts in another section, and a section on prayer. He says, ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks, the door will be opened. Which of you, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. Before Jesus wraps up his words on the law, comes to its highlight, boiled down into doing for others as you would have them do to you, he first goes to how God treats us. He gives us in his words full assurance that God, who is good, will give us good gifts as certainly as that earthly fathers give good gifts to their children when they ask him. Yes, even though, as Jesus reminds us and puts in there, we are evil, yet God gives us good. Though we're sinful, though we're self-centered, legalists and lawbreakers, yet God certainly will give us good gifts if we ask him for it. Though we're unworthy and undeserving, he says, God will listen to you. He hears our prayers and promises us good gifts. That's love. That's grace. And the very fact that it's the Son of God, Jesus Christ, speaking these words just underlines it all. He came to earth, not just to give us some more laws, not just to tell us what the law is really about and to be just a teacher. No, he came to fulfill the law, to live by it, a perfect life, fulfilling it perfectly, doing all that was required, and yet also at the end paying the penalty for all lawbreakers in death and the wrath of God. And all of it for our sake. God's law is never detached. It is never impersonal. Because it's always the law that was given us by our Father who gives us good gifts. It is the law that was fulfilled and lived by the Son of God, and it is the law that is put into our hearts, written on our hearts by the Spirit to truly make it spiritual. You cannot understand that until you know God and have tasted of his grace, and that he gives good gifts to those who do not deserve it. Gives good gifts to you and me, to all who ask him, even though we are unworthy. And it's only once we've understood and start to see some of God's grace also in those couple of verses, do we start to feel the full depth of what Jesus actually is saying here and how he ends the Sermon on the Mount. So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. We're snapped out of our self-centeredness, not by some magical words, not by some better understanding of God's law. No, Jesus says, consider God and consider God's grace. What do you have that you deserved? What do you have that you didn't receive? What do you have that isn't a wonderful gift from the Father of lights? then how can you make yourself the center of everything that goes on around you? How can you focus on what makes you different from your spouse or your sibling or your neighbor? Because we are all the same, and God has shown us all the same grace in Jesus Christ, time and time again. Every time we struggle with sin, struggle with our self-centeredness, struggle with that spiritual nature of the law, grace is there in Jesus Christ. And we are all alike in that. Our self-centeredness isn't solved by just some law or some words on a wall. We need something greater, really, to kick our egos into orbit. And only God's grace and God Himself, greater than the law, greater than us, can do that. Then whatever we think we deserve falls to the ground when we consider who we really are before Him. It's with Him as our reference point, we start to see how similar sinful people made in God's image really are. And His grace makes it possible we can start putting this golden rule into practice to do to others as you would have them do to you. And how we need God's grace. Like Jesus shows us the full extent of the law, not just pointing out the negatives as don't do this, don't do that, don't do to others what you would not have them not do to you. Or even its positive character saying, go, do, give, as you would have people do to you. It's a high calling. A giving is required of yourself, and yet it's why Jesus prefaces it with God as gives to you. He gives you His grace. He gives you His Son. He gives you His Spirit. He supplies for all those who seek to keep His law. Because the law isn't impersonal, and it is not mechanical. You can count on the God who gives the law to give also help in putting the law into practice. The Golden Rule, it is a wonderful title for these words of Jesus Christ. It is also worthy of being put on walls. And just consider how many different problems in the world would be solved if we all took these words of Jesus Christ to heart. Think of racism, oppression, abuse, and so many more. But it isn't just solved by golden letters on a wall. We need to know God. We need to know His grace and our sin. We need to come to Jesus Christ and really, as we see here, just sit at His feet, learning to see our unworthiness and how our neighbor is like us. And then by God's help, we might do to others what we would have them do to you. Amen.